Hi, everyone. This is Larry Jorgensen. I'm the author of the book Make It Go in the Snow. It's about people and ideas in the history of snowmobiling. And we're going to talk about some of the interesting parts of the book in the show. And I appreciate the opportunity. So let's make it go.
You're listening to Rick Flynn.
With a shout out from London Town, it's Rick Flynn presents... Now, ladies and gentlemen, your MC for the affair, Rick Flynn.
I'll tell you what, everybody, I've got the old news dog with me once again, and this guy, he keeps churning out the books. And right when I first met him, he had a book which everybody in the world could understand and relate to. It was called The Coca-Cola Trail, People and Places in the History of Coca-Cola. And that was a great book, and it turned out to be so great, people were so interested in it, he published a second book on the Coca-Cola Trail, More People and Places in the History of Coca-Cola. That was two books right there. I love both of them. Now, you had another book he wrote about a shipwreck which happened in the Great Lakes region. The ship was called the Bangor, Maine. Wasn't it, Larry?
That's correct. It was called Bangor, the city of Bangor, because the guy who paid to have it built was from Bangor, Maine, so he named it after his hometown, although at the time he had moved to Michigan and was living in Michigan.
There we go. And that was a boat, not a ship. It was like a cargo boat. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, it was pretty good size. I mean, it was really a ship. That particular time, it had 250 Chrysler automobiles on board, and that was 1926, and he had 1927 Chryslers on the car, on the ship, and got them all rescued and rescued the crew as well.
Right now, I guess you can call that a ship with that many cars on board. It was a cargo ship. And what that book was called, what, Larry?
It was called Shipwrecked and Rescued.
Right. And we did a whole show on that. Fascinating show. I highly recommend it. Look it up, everybody. It's part of our library of over 200, soon to be 250 one-hour shows that we've done here on Rick Flynn Presents, the worldwide podcast. And I am delighted to bring back my guest today, who has done it again, Larry Jorgensen. Who is Daniel C. Blaney of Morocco, Indiana?
That's a wonderful vintage antique snowmobile museum. And he's got quite why not operation there. I have never been, but my publisher has been, and some people I know have been to, and they say it's a wonderful museum to visit.
All right, I have Mr. Blaney's quote here, and I quote: "I have read many snowmobile books over the years, and I believe Larry Jorgensen's, that's you, was very informative and easy to read. It shows that Larry has done an excellent job researching information. I have recommended the book Make It Go in the Snow to all of my snowmobiling friends. I look forward to handing out copies to them at Christmas." And there is the quote, Daniel C. Blaney, Antique Snowmobile Museum, Morocco, Indiana. And ladies and gentlemen, that is why we're here today, because Larry has indeed researched the topic and come up with another book that is just fascinating, because he has got this natural born inquisitiveness, if I could say that about him. His most recent book, I think, and I'm probably wrong, he's probably written two more since then, but the one we're talking about today It's called Make It Go in the Snow, People and Ideas in the History of Snowmobiles. And Larry, I am in the Midwest USA. You are down in what is soon to be Mardi Gras country down there in Louisiana. I would guess it's not snowing and not as freezing cold as what it is up here. But do you get snow down there in Louisiana at all, or is it very rare?
It's rare. We did get some this year. It stayed around for about 3 days, and then it was gone. I guess a transient snowbird. I have a home down here in Louisiana, and I try to get up to Upper Michigan as often as possible because I really enjoy that country. And of course, they get a lot of snow up there. They get, in a typical winter, they'll get up to 300 inches of snow. So they do no snow.
I'm glad I don't live there, Larry.
Yeah, it's a challenge. They call people that live in the Upper Peninsula, they're called Upers, because they live north of the Mackinac Bridge. They're called Upers, and those Upers know how to live in the snow.
Boy, isn't that right. I was driving an automobile, and I was driving through the state of Iowa. This was years ago, and it was the winter time. And you know, Iowa, Larry, I'm sure you know, it's flatlands.
It sure is.
Real flat. And they had these teenage boys that were on the farm property. I was on the expressway. And parallel to the traffic on the freeway, they had, of course, a fence and the guardrails. And then there was the private property owned by the farmer, and that's where all the crops grew. But of course, this was the dead of winter, and everything was covered with snow. Now, on the outside rim of the crop field, they had a road big enough to, say, put the farm machinery, a pickup truck, or whatever. In other words, there was no crops grown there. It was kept as a road for the farmer, and in the winter, the boys were taking the snowmobiles, which I watched, and rode parallel with them. I'm on the freeway. They're on these snowmobiles on the farmer's road, and they were going as fast as I was. These kids love those snowmobiles in the state of Iowa, and that's all I know about them. I've never ridden on one. I've seen video. I've watched them on TV, but that's all. How in the world, Larry Jorgensen, did you get interested enough in snowmobiles to write a book about them called Make It Go in the Snow?
Well, it's not only about snowmobiles, but it's about snow vehicles. And we have some interesting chapters in there about what I would consider snow vehicles. Ideas that sort of got out of hand, but became very successful. But, you know, to answer your question, I was raised in northern Wisconsin. And when snowmobiling first started, I got addicted to it. And that was back about 1963, as I recall, 64. Bought a snowmobile and got really involved in it. We put on snowmobile shows across the Midwest, expositions. Got involved with a snowmobile race team. I was fortunate enough to establish a relationship with the Pabst Brewing Company. And Pabst came to me and said, you seem to know a lot about snowmobiling. What can we do to get involved in snowmobiling? And so I suggested we have a race team because I wanted to race. And we did have a snowmobile race team and did rather well. You talk about the boys there in Iowa, sort of familiar with snowmobiling in that area, was involved for three different years in a snowmobile race that went from Winnipeg, Canada to St. Paul, Minnesota. And of course, it was a 3-day race. That area in Manitoba and in North Dakota was somewhat similar in the way you described Iowa. In fact, a very popular snowmobile race driver, when I asked him, because he'd run the race before, I said, what's the snow like there in Manitoba? And he described it this way. He said, said, well, it's about 3 feet deep and about 5 feet away.
I believe that.
It was rough riding, but anyhow, it was fun. It was cold. That one year we ran that race, it got down to 40 below zero at the start of the race, and you were glad to be getting out of Winnipeg, that's for sure.
All righty. Here, let me go to your book. It says, and I quote, Michigan plays a minor yet important part in this detailed history of snowmobiles. The first snowmobile was created in 1913 by a Ford dealer in New Hampshire.
Correct.
He took the rear wheels off of a Ford Model T and replaced them with dual wheels covered by track. And by tracks, you're talking about those things that a tank or a bulldozer would have. Is that fair?
That's right. And on the front, we had skis instead of wheels.
Yeah, and on the front two wheels of this Model T, they put on skis.
And he, people say, well, snowmobiles, that's a pretty new thing. But you hit it on the head. He built that in 1913 and actually copyrighted the name snowmobile in 1917. So it's a snowmobile by name has been around a long time.
He patented his invention and called it a snowmobile.
Correct.
A company later bought the patent and made 3,500 kits a year.
And then there were others that saw what was going on, and a company in a little bitty town of Almena, Wisconsin. It was actually a machine shop out there. The guys made farm implements and so forth, and two brothers owned it, and one of them was very creative in the shop, the other was creative in coming up with ideas, and they decided they would try that concept, and they actually developed a snowmobile called the Eskimobile. And in fact, they made three different models, and they were very successful with the Eskimobile. When they weren't making farm implements and the farmers were all out in the fields, they would be making snowmobiles, be making the Eskimobile.
Now, what was the difference between your Model T snowmobile that was trademarked with that name and the Eskimo-mobile or whatever you're saying?
Well, with the Eskimobile, they had several ways of creating it. One of them, they would actually take an existing car body. So you rode inside, and they would take the car body and attach all the mechanism to it to go in the snow. They also developed a technique to raise an older car, make it go through the snow, and then they made it one that was like a bulldozer that would go through trees and all kinds of commotion, and they were very successful with their Eskimobile for quite a while until other means of transportation took over. But they were very creative, one in the shop, one out getting the ideas, and they had quite a following for a while.
Now, does that mean that these guys you're talking about took an automobile, they put the snowmobile type wheels or tracks on the bottom so it would go in the snow, but yet you could sit inside the cab of the car and get heat and not even be exposed to the elements?
That's correct. Pretty much that was their concept. Was they originally started out with taking, just a car, and then they were able to purchase car body. And so they would really start from scratch with that, and they were very successful with those. In fact, there was even a group up in Alaska that had them that actually raced them. So they got around for a while.
Right. And I had no knowledge until you just now told me, but there is such of a thing as a snowmobile that has a heater that you don't even need to experience the bitter cold of the ice and the snow.
Sounds like a good idea to me.
Boy, it is. Are they still manufacturing them, or is that part of the history? Snowmobile I've seen, you know what they remind me of and what the boys, the young teens in Iowa had? They had something I would really say, I'm being fair when I compare it, when I go to the river or to the ocean and I see the boys and girls out there on their jet skis.
Very similar.
It looks very similar. It's like a motorcycle, if you will, but the seat is big enough, usually, well, sometimes only for one person. Sometimes you could have a seat big enough for two, but it looks like a jet ski you would ride on the water, except for it's a snow vehicle you ride on the snow. Are you saying that even today, in the year 2025, that you can go out and get yourself a snowmobile type vehicle and you'll be inside the cab, you'll be surrounded by heat, you won't have to worry about freezing. It's basically a car, if you will, but it rides on the snow. Are they making them today?
Well, I think there's a few of them out there, but certainly not the Eskimobile. But there are companies that have made enclosed snowmobiles similar to what you're describing. The Eskimobile, actually what took that company out of business was World War II, and they lost their manpower, and they lost the ability to get an adequate supply of steel because everything was going to the war. So both the steel and the men in the shop that were building were unavailable, and it really forced the company to go out of business.
Right. Well, if you want to know somebody who is good with tools and a good Mr. Fix-It or inventor type guy, you have no further to go than to look up the farmer. And sure enough, you're saying the farmers were ones who were on the forefront of the development of what we now call a snowmobile.
Well, that certainly was one of them, and there were lots of others, and there were various attempts at making a snow vehicle, various attempts at using different ways of propelling the vehicle. There was, for example, there was an air power.
Oh, with a fan? Did it have a fan on the back of it?
See, that's correct. There was this started back as early as the 1920s.
Well, that's just like the boat. The boat where it allows you to take and go into the swamps, what the alligator men have in your Civil. New Orleans. Yeah, you've got, what is that boat called with the fan on the back?
It's an airboat is what it is.
Yeah, airboat. And it's got this gigantic fan, but allows the alligator fishermen to go in very non-deep, shallow water.
And it's quite an experience. I've ridden one, and they're very loud because it's basically an airplane engine on the back. In fact, the first one that I'm aware of was actually built in the 1920s by my grandfather up in Eagle River.
Oh, no.
Just outside of Eagle River, Wisconsin. It was about 12 miles from where he lived, which he had a resort. It was about 12 miles to town to get supplies. And of course, roads weren't plowed in those days. So to get to town and return was a 2-day trip. So he and his friend built this thing he called the Snow Devil. And it indeed did have the airplane powered engine on the back. And in talking to my relatives who knew of the machine, of course, before my days, they say that thing would go through the woods and knock it down limbs off of trees and making a heck of a racket, but it cut down that trip to town for supplies from 2 days to one quick trip, you know. So it was quite an invention in those days, even though it made a lot of noise, it got a lot of attention.
Very, very well. As the author, that's you, makes it abundantly clear, over the years, backyard tinkerers, high schoolers, and just guys with a vision created snowmobiles of all shapes and sizes. If you have any interest in snowmobiles, you're going to ski-doo through the Make It Go in the Snow book. And that was a quote by a guy named Tom Powers from Michigan in books.
Well, I appreciate that quote. And, you know, and if you're into old snowmobiles, there are several museums. We talked about the gentleman in Indiana. A very big museum is up at the Top of the Lake Museum, which is in Upper Michigan, Navanway, Michigan. They have a tremendous display. There's also several that I'm aware of out in New Hampshire. There, I think there's at least two in New Hampshire. And then there's an interesting one in Kimball, Minnesota, where the gentleman's, his sons started refurbishing John Deere tractors and other tractors. And that got out of control. And they decided they wanted to go to something else. So they started collecting snowmobiles and refurbishing them. And they have over 200 snowmobiles of various ages in a in buildings out there in Kimball, Minnesota. And you can see them there. Another interesting one is in Polson, Montana. It's called the Miracle of Americas, and it's a huge place. It's got, at least a dozen buildings, and it's on a 4.5-acre site, open car exhibits, air exhibits. I mean, there's a lot of them around to see, so if you're into that, looking for old vintage snowmobiles, there's plenty of museums to go to.
Now, the home office of John Deere, I know at one time, I'm going to guess maybe it still is, but that is a company based out of the state of Minnesota, right?
No, actually, John Deere did get involved in building snowmobiles for a while.
Yeah, when I was in Minneapolis, they were all over the place there. Did they move the home office out of Minnesota, or you don't know?
Well, John Deere's snowmobiles were made in Wisconsin. They were made in Horicon, Wisconsin. But actually, John Deere's corporate is still in Iowa. And
They're in Iowa?
Yeah. But their whole thing, when they were in making snowmobiles, I'm making a guess at this, but I think for about 6 or 7 years, and they made a real sturdy one. In fact, the last year that I rode that Winnipeg race, I did ride a John Deere snowmobile in that race, and they were good, but like everything else John Deere makes, they were extremely well built and consequently a little heavy, but they would go. They really had a good idea, and it's too bad they didn't stay with it. You know, I think a lot of the times in the winter when the farmers are not farming, but they're getting ready for the upcoming spring, and they'd go in and look at new tractors and so forth. A lot of times the tractor dealer, he'd throw in the deal a new snowmobile to lock up the deal for buying a big expensive tractor. Well, the farmers had nothing to do in the winter, so they enjoyed using the snowmobile when they couldn't be out in the fields planting the crops.
Boy, I'll tell you, that's what those teen kids were doing in Iowa. I'm telling you, Larry, I was on the expressway, and the road was parallel. And these boys on these snowmobiles were darn near going as fast as I was. They were wasting no time out there in that abandoned snow-covered field on these darn snowmobiles. Those kids were living it up. I'm telling you, Larry, they loved it.
You talk about running alongside a highway. One time we were in a race in North Dakota. And it was, instead of being a oval race, it was kind of a cross-country race. And I noticed the track, at one point, you went out, you rode alongside a road in the ditch line. And I noticed up ahead of me, there was a huge crowd standing around this one spot alongside the road. And I thought, well, that's strange. And I'm boogieing along. And I get to this spot, and there's a big embankment across the ditch there. It must have been a driveway embankment. And you hit that thing, and it would throw you up in the air. And I didn't dump, but a lot of guys were dumping over. And that explains why there was a crowd at that particular place, because there was plenty of action to see.
That's right. Now, other than what I talked about at the beginning of the show, what I failed to mention is a recurrent theme that you always have in every book that you write. And not only do you do excellent research, you put forth the topic, be it Coca-Cola, be it the cargo ship out of the Michigan up there, be it the snowmobiles, make it go in the snow. But what the recurrent theme is in all of your books, you try to publish what you would call a book that you say husbands, wives, couples of all sorts, they can go and visit places physically in the country where it backs up what the book says.
That's true. We try to take people on trips we've experienced. In fact, I had the opportunity to ride with a group out of Upper Michigan. I rode with them for 3 years. I think they actually ran, for 8 or 9 trips. And every time they would, this was back in the early days, the 1960s, even before that, 1950s, of snowmobiling. Their whole mission, the group was called the Peninsula Pathfinders, and their whole mission each year is to go a little bit further and to prove that there was a need for trails, for snowmobile trails. In those days, there was no snowmobile trail. You just went out and plowed along the ditches and plowed through the woods and got to where you were going. And at one point, this group, and I didn't ride on this particular trip, but they went from Marquette, Michigan, all the way to the Atlantic Ocean. And there is a picture in the book of one of the members of the Pathfinder Club actually snowmobiling in the Atlantic Ocean. So they were true pioneers of the snowmobile trail development. And because of their efforts, they did, in fact, encourage communities and states to sponsor and to create snowmobile trails. Interesting story, which is not in the book. I rode with the group. We were one of the first groups to cross the Mackinac Bridge by snowmobile. We always say we were first. I think we were probably second. But it was interesting. A Michigan State policeman guided us across. There was about 12 in line. The officer told us, he said, "Now you need to get in line behind me and stay in line. We're going to go at my speed and we're going to cross the bridge from Upper Michigan to Lower Michigan." So we get right to the top of the bridge and we're starting to go down. And a friend of mine pulls out of the line and passes not only everybody in the line, but also passes the state police officer's car.
I'm sure they were happy about that.
Well, he of course pulled him over, told him get back in line. You know, you can't be doing this. When we got across the bridge, I turned to him and I said, "John, what were you doing? You passed everybody, including the police officer." And this is the part that's not in the book. And he turned to me and he said, "Well," he said, "I wanted to be the first snowmobiler to get a ticket on the Mackinac Bridge."
Oh, my. Now, how could they ride the snowmobile in the ocean? Was the ocean frozen over at the time?
No, it was not. And today, there are actually competitions with snowmobiles going across ponds and lakes and so forth when they're open, because they're light enough and that track gives them enough momentum that they can scoot across the water and end up on the other side. So he was just in the water. The track gave him enough momentum that he could ride in the Atlantic Ocean for a while and then get back to shore. So it was quite a sight, and he just did it to show that they had been to the Atlantic Ocean.
Now, wouldn't it be better, though, if your MO was to do water only and not snow? Wouldn't you be better off just to do your jet ski?
Yeah, this was just a challenge. It was something for even now when they do the competition on ponds and lakes and so forth, it's more a competition for guys that already have snowmobiles and they can't race them in the summer. So what are we going to do with it? Well, they do grass racing and they also do this thing across the water on ponds and lakes. It's something to keep you busy when you can't run in the snow.
Right. And John Deere was so excited about their interest and their production of the snowmobile, what we call a snowmobile today, that they actually threw it in on a deal if you would buy a certain amount, of John Deere equipment for the farm. They throw in the snowmobile for the kids or for whoever wanted to drive it.
That's right. And when there's snow in the fields, you might as well ride on top of the snow before you can plow it.
All righty. Something happened in your life in the year 1967. And it was in that year that you went out, Larry, and you bought something. What was that?
I bought an Arctic Cat snowmobile. I was living in Green Bay at that time. In fact, working with a TV station. Bought an Arctic Cat. Ironically, my Arctic Cat dealer was a shoe repair shop. That's how new the industry was. And his total inventory was two. He had one back in the shop where he repaired shoes, and he had one, the other one, in the back of his pickup truck. So I was definitely amongst the first snowmobile in Green Bay, Wisconsin, that's for sure.
All right. And I quote, "Subsequently, Larry," that's you, "joined a snowmobile enthusiast group and participated in long-distance rides. The most notable was an endurance test from Fairbanks, Alaska, to Seattle."
Yeah, that's correct, Ricky. And actually, this was a whole different thing. It wasn't with the cross-country riders. I've been approached by a gentleman who was told me, he said, "We're going to take this snowmobile test." And it was originally supposed to go from Point Barrow, but that failed. But it did go from Fairbanks to Seattle. And it was a twin track, and you were fortunate enough to sit inside. And it took us about 6 weeks through Alaskan snow and northern Canada snow and so forth to finally end up in Seattle, Washington. And there's probably more stories on that particular event than we've got time for, but it was definitely an experience.
All righty. Now, let me see here what we have. You have, all righty, you were involved, it says here, in the United States Snowmobile Association, USSA, and it says here, you were so immersed in the activity, one of your children, then a first grader, was ask what her father did, and the little girl replied, "He snowmobiles." And now it says you have written about them as well, including a concluding chapter telling of the various snowmobile museums he's discovered around the country. And is that part of what you mean when you say, if you read one of my books, I not only tell you the story, but I tell you where to go to experience it and look at it and see it with your own eyes? So with this book, where you would recommend the reader to go are these various snowmobile museums. Would that be right?
That's correct. And like I say, I know there's a couple in New Hampshire. The one that in Nobenway, Michigan, in the Upper Peninsula, is huge. They've got machines that, in fact, there's quite a story behind the Honda. Everybody says Honda didn't get into snowmobiling. Well, they tried. All sorts of machines that were homemade machines, or were companies maybe made two or three, and the one of them is at the museum at Nobenway, Michigan. It's called the Top of the Lake Museum. Of all the ones that I've been to, and I know the gentleman in Indiana has got a great one, and I haven't had the chance to go there, but I've had other people tell me about their visits there. Probably the two that would be closest to me would be Nobenway and, of course, Indiana. And I have been to the one in Nobenway, and it's amazing. Not only do they have the original old machines, but they've got a lot of memorabilia, old snowmobile suits and jackets and books. And of course, they've got our book up there if you're looking for a place to buy the book. But the book is also available online.
Right. I'm going to tell everybody where to get the book, and we're going to do that at the end of the show. But you're a married man, aren't you, Larry?
Yeah, in spite of my insanity and locking myself.
That's what I'm saying. Where do you get a? Is this woman sane, or is she as nuts as you to get on a doggone snowmobile in Fairbanks, Alaska, and travel on that darn thing to get to Seattle? And how long does that take? How many days?
Weeks.
Where did you sleep?
Wherever you could. Sometimes it was an enclosed snowmobile, so sometimes we'd curl up in there. It just depends if we could find a place to sleep along the road. It wasn't really a road, along the trail.
Well, doesn't it run? What's it run on? Gas?
Yeah, it was a twin track. It was made in Ohio by the Allsport Company. You could get inside. Our original plan was to fly the experimental snowmobile up to Point Barrow. Well, we tried three different times to get out of Point Barrow, and it was so cold up there the things kept breaking. And finally, we had gotten quite a ways out, and we had a breakdown again. And the Navy has a research station out of Point Barrow. And one of the guys in a weasel type vehicle came out to rescue us. And he said, "Where are you going?" And we said, "We're going to Seattle, but we're going to cross the Brooks Mountain Range first." And he said, "No," he said, "you'll die out there." And so ultimately, after we got, he was gracious enough to get us into the research station, and we got the sled fixed again. And then we flew it by cargo plane back to Fairbanks. And at that time, the road to Prudhoe Bay, which was a snow trail, was being built from Fairbanks to Prudhoe Bay, and because of the oil discovery. So we loaded experimental snowmobile up with enough fuel to take us about 200 miles north of Fairbanks, and then turn around and get back to Fairbanks, where we had a support vehicle waiting. And then the support vehicle had extra fuel and parts, and stayed with us all the way to Seattle.
And now, your wife was not on trip.
No, she was not. She was smart enough to avoid that problem.
Well, tell her, give her a message from me. Tell her I've got a lot of psychiatrists and psychologists that write books that we talk about right on this show. So I'll be happy to recommend one, because she married a husband that sometimes can get a little crazy.
That's right. But we're having fun doing it. You know, there's that old country song that goes, "I've always been crazy. It keeps me from going insane." And
Yeah. Oh, I'm telling you what. Yeah. Oh, my. I don't know how you do it. I am telling you, the last place you would get me is on a snowmobile from Fairbanks, Alaska to Seattle with no hotel to stay at in the along the way.
No, the only hotel we had is when we got to Seattle, and there was a real story about that. But because Champion Spark Plugs was one of the sponsors, they had arranged for a press conference and for rooms down at a downtown hotel in Seattle. So we did have that luxury once we finally got to Seattle.
Make It Go in the Snow provides a fun look at the history of a few of the many thousands of snow travel ideas and those enthusiasts who gave them birth. Captured and recorded are a wide variety of snowmobile ideas without offering judgment on any individual venture. Join the author, that's you, as he pays tribute to all of those ideas, past, present, and future. But keep watching, because more snow excitement is waiting to be created. Does that mean that you're actually planning another book on these doggone snowmobiles, Larry?
Well, it's sort of like when we did the Coke book. You know, we did the first book, and so many people responded to it that I started a collection, what I call, we didn't do it book. Pretty soon I had enough information to do the second one and to do research for the second one. People would contact me and say, "Well, you didn't talk about this particular place." And so we'd look it up and do some research and get some photographs and so forth, and we did the second book. So that ultimately could be the problem, a nice problem, with the Make It Go in the Snow. We may have to go with Make It Go in a little more detail. We do have some ideas that are sort of talked about already in the first book, and one is about snowmobiling, snow vehicles in the Antarctica, and that's a fantastic story. And also, you know, we talk about the snowmobile that was built in 1917. Well, actually, the first one that you could call a snow vehicle was built in 1901, and it was probably not only the first, but the largest ever built. It was called the Lombard Log Hauler. It would look like, and we've got a little bit in the book about it. It would look like if you'd taken an old steam engine and put tracks on it, and they would use it in the woods to haul logs out instead of horses and sleighs. And that crazy machine that was built in 1901 was steam powered, and it was a 15 ton ton log hauler. It was like a big steam engine going through the woods, and it would pull sleds of logs and so forth. And it definitely cut down on the number of horses and sleighs that had to be used to get the logs out of the woods. And that was built in the early 1900s. The man's name was Alvin Lombard, and he was from the East. I think he was from Maine, if I'm not mistaken. And he created this thing called the Lombard Log Hauler, and there was a copy of it made a couple of years later called the Phoenix. And what happened, the gentleman who owned the Phoenix Manufacturing Company, who was from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, had heard of the Lombard. He bought one, took it back to Wisconsin, and made a deal with Lombard that he would make a similar machine and call it the Phoenix right there in Wisconsin. And he did, and every time he made one, he had to pay $1,000 to Lombard as sort of a royalty fee on making the Phoenix. But he made a couple hundred of them, and they were used primarily for the same purpose, was to haul logs and heavy timber out of the woods.
Now, was that one that was that powerful to haul the logs? Was that what I just read earlier? Was the first snowmobile made from a Ford Model T, or was that a different snowmobile?
No, that was totally different. The way Lombard got into it, he had a shop, and he was making various things for the timber industry, tools and so forth. And he had met a gentleman. It was a customer of his, and they got talking on a train ride one time, and the customer said, Alvin, he said, you know, you're very talented in that shop. Can't you devise some sort of a machine where we could replace all these horses that are very expensive and take many to haul the logs out, a machine that would do that job? So Alvin went back and designed this thing called the Log Hauler, and had designed it and built his first model in a year. And it was tremendously successful for many years for the logging industry, because it certainly cut down on the need to feed and maintain large herds of horses and so forth. So it was a good idea, and he was an extremely talented builder.
Absolutely. Is he a farmer, by the way?
No, he was just a very, very talented man with a shop, and the log hauler was the result of him talking to a man who, in fact, was in the lumber industry.
Absolutely amazing. Now, if somebody listening wants to get and own a snowmobile, is John Deere, if you buy a certain amount of equipment, are they still throwing them in today's day and age, or is that part of the history of yesteryear?
I think that's probably history. It was told to me many years ago that I had ran into someone who had a John Deere and asked him, how did he get it? He said, well, I've got this big farm and we were snowed in for the winter, and I was getting a new tractor for next spring. And he said, you know, the dealer said, if you make the deal, I'll throw in a snowmobile. And he said, I've talked to a couple other farmers that had the same offer, buy a tractor and get a snowmobile. So, I don't think it was industry policy. I think it was probably a motivational sale by a particular tractor dealer.
Well, as big as these fields were in Iowa, when I observed the kids using these snowmobiles and their knowledge of how to drive them, boy, they weren't fooling around. They knew how to operate the machinery. They did it. It was every bit as fast as a lot of motorcycles I've seen, but of course it ran in the snow. The fields of Iowa, they were covered with snow, and they ran them on the outline. They didn't have stalks of corn or anything underneath them that had been disc away. They were riding them more on the smooth surface of where the vehicle at the farm would ride. But they had, oh God, hundreds if not thousands of acres there. And you know, who knows? Maybe that snowmobile was thrown in at that time. You never know in Iowa.
You never know, do you? No, you don't know, but It wasn't a John Deere requirement. It was just something that some of the dealers were doing to sort of, you know, cement the sale, so to speak, you know, to make it happen.
Right. Now, is John Deere, do they to this day, as we speak, do they even manufacture such a pleasure mobile like that?
No, they don't. They have gotten into the ATV business.
You're talking quad runners, tricycles, and the quad runners that run out in the woods.
Yeah, and even the more utility type vehicles that are used around the farm or used, you know, basically for utility purposes, not as much designed for recreational use, although they are used for recreational use. But typical of the quality that comes out of John Deere, these are very well built, and a lot of other companies that are making ATVs also make UTVs, and they make machines that are used for multiple purposes in the snow, and they're very good. They've taken the track design and have taken it to a much better level.
Right. If you wanted yourself to buy a snowmobile right now, today, where would you go?
I would probably go to either my closest Polaris dealer. That was kind of one of my favorite sleds always, was Polaris, or Ski-Doo, which Ski-Doo was really the pioneer in the United States of bringing snowmobiles in. Ski-Doo was made up in Canada and still is. So those are the two big ones that I would go to. It's always important to get a good dealer who could get you parts when you need them and know how to fix them. Arctic Cat, just recently, Textron owned Arctic Cat, and Textron just in this past few months announced that they are not going to make Arctic Cats anymore. Now, the story is that there are a couple of companies looking to buy Arctic Cat, and Arctic Cat may be alive again. Another one that is going out of business this year and already announced was Yamaha. Yamaha was probably one of definitely was one of the largest motorcycle companies to get into the snowmobile business, and they made a good one. They made a fast one, easy to handle, and so forth. And when they announced this year that they were going to cease production, that was really a shock to the industry, because they made such a good snowmobile, and it was really a shock to see them get out. But, the snowmobile industry has become overloaded with machines, a lot of inventory, and there were a couple of hard winters where sales were down, and consequently, a lot of the manufacturers were starting to look at, why are we in this business? We're losing money. And so some of them, in fact, did get out of making snowmobiles.
And Yamaha is leaving the business.
They are. They're definitely announced that they have quit making them, and of course, but for a long time, there will be a parts supply and so forth. And I'm sure that if you have a Yamaha dealer, he will certainly know how to fix a Yamaha and to get needed parts for them. I guess my heart belongs to Polaris. I think they've done a wonderful job. And they were one of the pioneers in the industry, as was Arctic Cat. And you kind of find a brand that you like and you stick with it. I'm sure the guys that are listening, there are Ski-Doo owners and writers, would debate that issue with me, pointing out that Ski-Doo was one of the first ones to come to the United States, and they still make some great sleds. So there's still a lot of good choices out there.
Now, Ski-Doo, which makes snowmobiles, is that any relation, if you will, if I could use that term, to the jet ski company we've all heard of, Ski-Doo?
Yes.
Oh, they are. They're brother and sister there?
In fact, the Ski-Doo parent company, I'm not totally accurate on everything here, so bear with me, but it's Bombardier out of Canada, and they are very active in several things. A few years ago, they bought Evinrude Johnson outboard motor business and the boats that go with it, and that's being made in Wisconsin. And they're also known, Bombardier is also known for making jet planes, you know, private jet planes. Like if, when you get rich, Ricky, and you want a plane to haul you around, Bombardier's got one.
Oh, I've been on the private jets.
And they also are big in making trains, you know, the modern passenger trains. So they're a big operation. I may not be totally correct on what I'm saying, but as best as I know about Bombardier, and there is in the book a picture of Bombardier himself, the youngster, when he was 15 years old, he invented in his father's shop, he invented the first air powered, in fact, the first snowmobile of any kind up there in Canada. And there's a picture of it in the shop. And after he got it built, his father was amazed, but told him, take it apart because somebody's going to get hurt with that thing.
Right. I believe that. Yeah.
But there's a great picture of it in the book. And in fact, Bombardier has a museum up in Canada where you can see a remodel of that and a lot of other history about the Skidoo snowmobiles and other snowmobiles that Bombardier makes. So they're big. They're one of the biggest in the industry. And in fact, the gentleman in New Hampshire, Mr. Crane, who has that museum in New Hampshire, I wish I could think of the name of the town, but anyhow, it's the Crane Museum. He was the first, claims to be, and I think he was, the first person to ride a Skidoo snowmobile in the United States. At that time, he was working for a dealer, not a, obviously a snowmobile dealer, just a dealer of vehicles and parts and so forth. The sales rep from Skidoo had convinced this dealer to be a Skidoo dealer. So they brought in a Skidoo for him to see, and this Mr. Crane, who was working for the dealership, took the snowmobile out for a test ride. And he claims that fame is, in fact, he was the first person to ride a Skidoo snowmobile in the United States. So if you get a chance to look up the Crane Snowmobile Museum, it's in New Hampshire, and he's there, and he'll tell you the story. Not only show you his machines, that he's got quite a collection, but he'll tell you the story about being the first person to ride a Skidoo in the United States.
Right. Now, if I ever need to go back on my own private jet, you say you have a driver for me or a pilot?
I wish I did.
You're not a pilot, are you?
No, I'm not. In fact, when we're doing the snowmobile shows, and we did them all over the Midwest, snow country, my partner with me in this venture was, in fact, a pilot. And he had a Mooney. That was pretty much of a goer. And we'd take the plane. We'd go explore a place to do another snowmobile show. And we'd take the Mooney. And I was always amazed at his ability to fly that plane. And I knew him from... We were both working at the TV station at the time, and he was an engineer. I was in the news department, and anytime there'd be a story that would break, you know, film at 10, that sort of thing, I'd get a hold of John, and I'd say, John, can you get the plane? Let's go cover this thing. And we covered a lot of stories by flying there, because in those days, you had to get film. You didn't rely on videotape being sent to you through the air. You know, it was quite an experience. So he was a good pilot. We landed in some crazy places, cow fields and snow-covered roads and so forth, but we came back alive.
Now, why didn't you use a helicopter for that?
Well, he was involved. There was like another guy at the TV station and a couple others. They actually had a little club, and I guess they decided with their club they would chip in, and what they could buy would be an airplane. And they bought a Mooney, which was a pretty fast little plane. And I used to enjoy riding in that with him, but I had no desire to try to pilot it.
Right. Okay. Oh, I believe that. And when I was on the jet, I made a terrible mistake, which I was corrected on. And I said to them, I said, oh man, this is wonderful. I love this. This is the first time I've ever ridden on a Lear jet. And they said, Rick, and they pulled me to the sides. Rick, this is much better than a Lear jet. Don't ever tell them if they're riding in a Gulf Stream that it's as not it's your first time on a Learjet. That's an insult. I said, oh, no, I'm sorry. I didn't know that. Don't call a Gulfstream a doggone Learjet. They're upset when you do that, Larry.
Okay. I'll keep that in mind because I never knew the difference either. So.
There you go. That's my advice to anyone in the private jet industry. If it's a Gulfstream, don't say Learjet. They're going to get all insulted. But at any rate, let me move on. It is time to do what you've been waiting to do, Larry. We're going to tell everybody about the book that we have been talking about, ladies and gentlemen. It is entitled Make It Go in the Snow: People and Ideas in the History of Snowmobiles. I'll repeat it. Make It Go in the Snow: People and Ideas in the History of Snowmobiles. Its author is our guest today, author Larry Jorgensen, Jorgensen, not O, Jorgensen. Larry Jorgensen. You can get the book, I know, on Amazon. Tell them where else they're going to get it, Larry.
Well, several of the museums and snowmobile dealers have got it. Also, the book has been published. The publisher is Modern History Press, and they're in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and you can get it through them. Their toll-free number is 888-761-6268. 888-761-6268. Or if you're a bookstore or even an individual, you can get it. There's a book distributor called Ingram. Nationally and even up into Canada, they are a distributor for published books. If you go to Ingram, they are, and you can get it from them too. If you're buying in quantity, either the Modern History Press or Ingram will sell it at a dealer price to you with quantity buying, and it allows you to either, if you're a snowmobile club, it makes a great fundraiser because you get it at 40% discount. If you're a store, whether you're a snowmobile dealer or a snowmobile club or just a bookstore that wants something to add to the inventory, they ship free, and they do provide a 40% discount off of the cover price, which means you can get it from them and make a few dollars. In fact, I've had a couple of clubs that have ordered from them and are using it as a fundraiser. So it's a great tool, and there's a lot of stories in the book that we haven't even had a chance to get to today. And so I recommend reading it, and you can learn about the Elison snowmobile, which is credited as being one of the first built on today's basic design. That was built in 1924 in Seder, and you could learn about the trips to the Antarctica and the large snow vehicle that turned out to be a large disaster. So colossal, I think, is the term we use. It was a colossal vehicle that turned out to be a colossal failure, and there's pictures of that in there, as well as the story as to how they were going to take it to Antarctica and so forth. So if you get a chance, get the book. There's a lot that we haven't had a chance to talk about.
Oh my. And that book, once again, Make It Go in the Snow. Now, you can't forget that. You know, a snowmobile, it's going to be moving through the snow like those teenagers I saw that had those darn things moving in Iowa in the snow-covered fields. And the book, Make It Go in the Snow: People and Ideas in the History of Snowmobiles, by our guest today, Larry Jorgensen. It is available in hardcover. Yes, it is available in paperback. Yes, it is available on Kindle for you Kindle users. Yes, get it on Amazon if you're looking for the single purchaser, for mom, dad, to give a gift to a child, to a relative. There's somebody crazy like this man I've been talking to the last hour. He'll ride the darn thing, but at any rate, it's there for you in Amazon in onesie twosies. And now, if you want it for your club or as a fundraiser, what do you say again? Where to go, Larry?
Well, you can go to the publisher in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
And they are who again?
Okay, let me get that out for you right here. It's Modern History Press. Modern History Press. Their toll-free number is 888-761-6269. And they're in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Modern History Press. And the publisher's name is Victor Volkman. And he's a wonderful guy to work with. And I'm very proud that he's publishing that book, as well as my shipwreck story and the Coca-Cola story. So you can get any of them, any of those three, either through the publisher or, again, through Ingram. You could contact Ingram and order all three if you want to.
Ladies and gentlemen, another fascinating hour with the man who researches the topics and hits the nail on the head. He not only provides you an interesting story about things he is interested in, but he leaves the trail behind and tells you where to go to see and hear and discover in your own mind, your own research, things such as these museums that hold the snowmobiles so you can see them and experience them with your own family, with your own eyes. A fascinating author, a good book. He has several of them out there and more, I'm sure, on the way. This is Rick Flynn speaking. It's been fun, but I've got to run. On behalf of myself and our author today, Larry Jorgensen, the old news dog from radio, from television, and now an author. All kinds of books being churned out faster than I can get them on the air. We're glad to have them. New shows every Wednesday on Rick Flynn Presents. We're happy to have you, everyone. Thank you for joining us. I'll see you next Wednesday with a brand new show. Good night.
Rick, I've enjoyed once again being on the show. We always have some interesting conversations. I'm always happy that you take us in a direction that brings out new part of the story. I really appreciate it. Look forward to being back with you again. My next book will deal with a ghost town, and it's in process right now. Should be ready in about 3 or 4 months, and maybe we can talk about a ghost town.
The preceding was a Rick Flynn production. This is your announcer, Chantal Marie speaking.